Welcome to the Deep Dive. If you need to cut through a mountain of source material and get right to the knowledge that matters, the surprising facts, the structural insights, you are definitely in the right place. Today, we're diving into the language that really defines modern data structure, linear geometry. And, you know, we're deliberately sidestepping the usual abstract algebra path. Our sources focus almost entirely on the geometric side of things. Vectors, matrices, seen geometrically. Which is, well, it's fundamental if you're serious about machine learning or advanced stats, right? So our mission today is pretty straightforward. Quickly pull out the vital, sometimes kind of counterintuitive, links between basic geometry like length and angle, and how they help reveal, well, the hidden dimensions and the variance structure inside huge data sets.
Yeah, and that geometric focus is, it's really key. If you try to tackle this stuff only symbolically, you get lost fast. It happens. But when you actually visualize these operations, you know, the angles between vectors, the lengths, projecting data onto a line, it just clicks. It makes things so much clearer, especially when you hit complex derivations, like for the chi squared distribution, for example. The visualization is really the shortcut.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Starting right at the beginning, the fundamental building block. What is a vector in this context?
Okay, so at its heart, a vector is basically just an ordered list of scalars. Think of them as components or features. So if you measure, say, a dollar features for one sample, you've got a dimensional vector. It lives in dollar dimensional space. And the sources really stress this. We treat points and vectors pretty much interchangeably. They're both just lists of numbers, coordinates.
Ah, okay. So whether it's a location, a point, or a direction movement, a vector, it's still fundamentally just that list of numbers. The list is the thing.
Precisely. And then naturally, when you have more than one sample, more than one vector, you stack them up. That gives you a matrix. A matrix called AR is just a rectangle of numbers, say rows and columns. And you really got to hold two pictures of this matrix in your head at the same time. First view. It's like stacking row vectors vertically. Each row is one data sample, one observation sitting there in dimensional feature space. Nullar samples means on the rows. Second view. Flip your perspective. Think of it as stacking column vectors horizontally. Each column is a single feature, maybe age or pixel intensity, measured across all dollar samples, dollar features. And depending on what you're doing, you kind of mentally switch between those views.
Got it. Rows are our samples, columns are our features.
Yeah.
And the operation that lets us switch perspectives, that's the transpose, right?
Exactly. The transpose, written age software. It's like taking your data table and just, well, flipping it on its side. Rows become colors, columns become rows. Sounds simple, maybe, but it's absolutely crucial because operations like ATD or all-out ATT, they're the starting point for almost all data analysis, really. It just swaps the dimensions. And yeah, like you said, flip it twice, ATTT, and you're right back to Aller.
Okay, here's where it starts getting really interesting, I think.
Yeah.
We move from just lists of numbers to actual geometric meaning through vector products. Let's start with the dot product.
Yeah.
A seat. D veal.
The dot product. Algebraically, super simple. Multiply the corresponding features together, then sum up those products. H90 plus 72 and so on. But the intuition is key. Always think row times column. Take a row vector, multiply it by a column vector element-wise, sum it up, and boom, you get a single number, a scalar.
And that single number. Why is it so powerful? It feels like just a calculation, but you're saying it defines the geometry.
It is the foundation. It connects directly to length and crucially to the angle between vectors. I mean, the length or magnitude of a vector, it's just the square root of that all dotted with itself, squared AV, which kind of makes intuitive sense, doesn't it? If a vector lines up perfectly with itself, the dot product should tell you something about its overall size. But the real mind bender is the dot product identity. One nullar of value equals the length of dollar times the length of dollar times the cosine of the angle between them. And here's the profound bit from the source material. We don't use the angle to find the dot product. We actually use this identity as the definition of the cosine of the angle. We're defining angle using algebra. It's backwards from high school geometry.
Whoa, okay. So we're basically creating the concept of an angle in, say, 500-dimensional space using this algebraic rule. And that gives us a perfect test for perpendicularity, orthogonality.
Exactly that. If the dot product, $1 visible, is zero, and the vectors aren't zero themselves, then that dollar CS must be zero, which means the angle theta is 90 degrees, or pi 2 radians. They're orthogonal, perpendicular. They point in completely independent directions, zero overlap.
Okay, let's level up. Matrix vector product, 8C. This feels more complicated, but you said it's fundamental. What's the geometric picture?
It's the linear combination rule. This is maybe the most important single idea. When you multiply a matrix dollars by a vector, the result, 8C, is always, always, always a weighted combination of the columns of dollar. The entries in the vector theta just act as the weights. 7-1 tells you how much of the first column of adder to use, 6-0 how much of the second, and so on. You just mix them together.
So AC is like a transformation. You feed in sexes and ASD laps it somewhere else, specifically into the space that's spanned by its own columns.
That's a perfect way to think about it. You're transforming from the input space, where six Starlies lives, into the output space defined by A's columns, the column space. And then the matrix-matrix product, ABA6, it's really just doing that dot product thing over and over. The entry in, say, the ith row and the jth column of the resulting matrix, it's just the dot product of the ith row of ith row and the jth column of dial, well, dollars, dollars.
Yeah.
Row times column again.
We've got the geometric toolkit now. Vectors, matrices, dot products defining length and angle, matrix multiplication as transformation. Now let's bring it back to data, to statistics. The source material connects this stuff directly to variance, especially using that ATI structure.
Yeah, it does. Let's say you have your data matrix, ATOR, and you've centered it, meaning you subtracted the mean from each feature column, so the average is zero. Then the variance matrix, let's call it clue a dollar, is basically ATA, sometimes scaled by odd dollars, the number of samples. And this matrix TO, it's incredibly rich. It holds all the information about how your features vary and how they co-vary with each other.
Okay, so QADAW captures the data spread and correlations. Now, what about reducing dimensions? What happens if we project the data?
Right, so imagine you take your centered data cloud and you project it down onto a single line, a line defined by some direction, a unit vector to us. The variance of those projected points, how spread out they are along that line, is given by this neat little formula, 2UDOCQU1. It's a quadratic form. It basically measures how much energy or spread the data has when you look at it from direction 2.
And here's the kicker, right? What if you find a direction, let's call it dollar, where that variance dollar is exactly zero?
That's the structural insight. If you find a non-zero vector where 2.qmu equals is dollar, it means the data has absolutely no spread when viewed from that direction in dollar. The implication is huge.
Right.
It means the entire data set must lie perfectly flat within a lower dimensional subspace. It's constrained.
Wait, walk me through that again. A lower dimensional subspace, like a plane. What does that mean for the data?
It's exactly like a plane or a hyperplane in higher dimensions. If your data lives in, say, 10 dimensions, but you find a zero variance direction in dollars, it means all your data points actually live within a nine-dimensional flat sheet, a hyperplane. And that hyperplane is specifically the one that's orthogonal perpendicular to dollars. The data just, it can't move in the dollar direction at all. It's completely squashed flat from that perspective.
So if I had data with, say, 10 features originally, but I found, I don't know, three different zero variance directions, does that mean my data isn't really 10-dimensional, it's actually living in like a 7-dimensional space, stuck at the intersection of those three hyperplanes.
Precisely. You've just discovered the affected dimension of your data set. It might be embedded in 10D space, but its intrinsic dimension is only 7. And the crucial link back to the matrix math is this. The set of all such zero variance directions, dollars. That set is exactly the null space of the variance matrix dollars. Remember the null space. It's all the vectors $2 Taylor sends to the zero vector. PUU equals $2. These are the directions where the data has no variance.
That's a fantastic connection. The null space of Q dollar tells you about the directions where your data is completely flat, constrained. Okay, let's pivot slightly. How does this null space idea help us understand solving the classic axis B ball problem? Finding $6 when we know ax and dollar.
Well, if a dollar is a nice square matrix and it's invertible, then its null space only contains the zero vector. No constraints, basically. In that case, you get a unique solution, sex Eckers A1BUL. The row space and column space cover everything. Easy peasy. But real-world data often gives you matrices that aren't square, or they're square but not invertible. They have a non-trivial null space. If bidolls happens to not be in the column space of air dollars, meaning dollar can't produce in dollars by combining its columns, then XCB has no exact solution. That's where the pseudo-inverse, the L or plus, comes in. It gives us a solution $6 plus A plus B dollar, and it's often called the closest twice solution, which is a bit cryptic but captures what it does.
Closest twice. Okay, break that down. What's the first closest?
The first closest is about the output. 6 plus plus chosen, so that's x plus plus is the vector in the column space of a dollar that is closest to the target vector dollars. It minimizes the error, the residual length xxb22. Geometrically, xx plus is the orthogonal projection of dollars onto the column space of...
Right, projection. But you said closest twice. What if there are multiple six-bellers that give the same minimal error? that project to the same closest point, xx plus null.
Ah, exactly. That happens if allers has a null space. You could add any vector from the null space to a solution 6x is n plus an, it's plus anls, x is error as xs. The result xs doesn't change. So the second closest is about the input, the solution vector 6s itself. Among all the 6lses that minimize the error, x is b. The pseudo inverse selects the unique one, 6less plus, that has the smallest possible length, the minimum norm, $6. It picks the simplest, shortest, least energetic solution that does the job.
Got it. Minimize the output error first, then minimize the input vector length. That makes sense. And this naturally involves projections.
Absolutely. The pseudo-inverse basically defines projection matrices. The combination PPAA plus $ creates the matrix that projects any vector onto the column space of dollars. That's where the outputs allob live. And the other combination, POPOA plus allobly, projects onto the row space of a dollar. That's the part of the input space that doesn't get squashed to zero by a dollars. And this ties into that beautiful geometric picture, the four fundamental subspaces. We find that the null space of A area, the stuff dollars maps to zero, is the orthogonal complement of the row space of a the stuff all earns from usefully. They are perfectly perpendicular subspaces, and together they span the entire input domain, $2. Any input vector, $6, can be split perfectly into a piece in the row space and a piece in the null space.
That's really elegant. So the row space part of $6 is what actually contributes to the output outlet, and the null space part just vanishes. A clean separation.
And that decomposition leads us right to the concept that wraps everything up. Rank. Okay, so rank. It starts with the idea of basis for a space. A basis is like the minimal set of building block vectors you need to create any vector in that space through linear combination. The dimension of the space is just how many vectors are in that minimal set in the basis. And a set of vectors forms a basis for the space they span if and only if they're linearly independent. None of them can be made by combining the others.
So rank is about the true essential dimension. Not just the number of columns or rows, but how many dimensions the matrix actually influences or spans.
Precisely. And the big theorem here, the cornerstone, is the fundamental theorem of linear algebra. It states that for any matrix dollar, the dimension of its row space, the row rank, is always equal to the dimension of its column space, the column rank. This common number, this shared dimension, is just called the rank of the matrix dollars. And we can connect rank directly back to the null space with the rank nullity theorem or connection. It says rank or dollar and two plus nullity n, which is the dimension of the null space, must equal the total dimension, the input space the matrix acts on. So if Euler maps from the Haas to somewhere else, then its rank plus its nullity must add up to 784.
Okay, let's bring this home with that concrete example you mentioned earlier, the MNIST handwritten digit dataset. How does rank show up there?
Right, MNIST3. You've got, say, 60,000 images, sample, so $60,000. Each image is flattened into a vector with 784 pixels, features. So it happened 8-4 SDA. So you have this huge $60,000 times 784 matrix dollars tools. You center it. Now you compute its rank. And the result is, well, it's surprisingly low. It's 712.
Wait, 712 out of a possible 784. So the data just misses 72 dimensions entirely.
That's exactly the interpretation. Since rank 712 plus nullity must equal 784, the nullity must be 784 by 34, tother and 12, 12 equals 7 tup and 2. Geometrically, this means there are 72 zero variance directions for this data set. 72 directions in that 784 dimensional pixel space where the data has no spread whatsoever. These 72 specific linear combinations of pixel values are effectively untouched, unused by any of the 60,000 handwritten digits in the training set. The mathematical space allows 784 dimensions, but the real world data is constrained. It only effectively lives in a 712 dimensional subspace.
That is the aha moment. Linear geometry tells us that even though we measured 784 pixel values, 72 of those dimensions or combinations are statistically irrelevant for describing these digits. They carry no information present in the data set.
And that's why this geometric view is so powerful. It's not just calculation. It's a tool for discovery. You're finding the actual constraints, the true structure imposed by the data itself.
Wow. What a deep dive. We went from just seeing vectors as lists to defining geometry with dot products, and then seeing how ATAE in its null space reveal these fundamental constraints in real data, like those 72 ghost dimensions in MNIST.
Right, and maybe that leads to a final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. If we consistently find that the rank of complex real-world data sets, you know, image data, sensor data, biological data, is much lower than the number of features we measure, like 712 versus 784, what does that fundamental mismatch really imply about the systems we're measuring? Are we always measuring redundant information? And more importantly, how can we use rank and these geometric ideas to systematically find the minimal set of variables that truly capture the essence of the system we're trying to understand? What are the real degrees of freedom?